listening to a program produced in 2010 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic lectures, readings, performances, and discussions that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To learn more about Aloud, please go to our website, www.aloudla.org. Mona Simpson's work means a lot to a great number of readers. I'm sure there are many of you here who followed her over the years, as I have. Her first novel, Anywhere But Here, attracted substantial attention and a devoted following, who've also kept up with her other much-praised novels, The Lost Father, A Regular Guy, and Off Keck Road. For those of you who've been waiting for the next Mona Simpson novel, this is a particularly joyous literary season. And tonight, Mona will discuss this new work, My Hollywood, along with her creative process and probably raising children, with award-winning novelist Michelle Hunnevin, who's most recently the author of the novel Blame. Both of our authors will be signing their books in the lobby afterwards tonight, and the books are on sale here, courtesy of our library store. My Hollywood is the tale of two women, a composer named Claire, who's married to a workaholic TV writer, and her Filipino nanny, Lola. It's a beautifully constructed portrait of American domesticity in the 21st century and an astute investigation into the many demands on the lives of women raising children today. Lola, the Filipina nanny, reminded me, who's at the heart of the book, of another great fictional portrayal of a immigrant woman in modern-day Los Angeles, John Retchie's miraculous Amalia Gomez. Michiko Kakutani in the New York Times, from whom praise does not come easily, praised Simpson's characters as keenly observed as the mother and daughter pair in Anywhere But Here, and as much an avatar as they were of the contingencies and compromises of the American dream. Mona Simpson, I guess we could say, is also a product of the American dream. Her father was a recent immigrant from Syria, and her mother was the daughter of a mink farmer and the first person in her family to attend college. Simpson studied poetry at Berkeley. She worked as an editor at the Paris Review, and her work has been awarded numerous prizes, including a Guggenheim, a Hodder Fellowship from Princeton, and most recently, a prestigious literature award from the American Academy of Arts and Letters. And in conversation with Mona tonight is the distinguished novelist Michelle Hunnevin, who's the author of three novels, Blame, Jamesland, and Round Rock. She's written nonfiction for a number of publications, including restaurant reviews for the LA Times and LA Weekly. And with Bernadette Murphy, she's the author of The Tao Gal's Guide to Real Estate. She's also been awarded numerous prizes, including a General Electric Foundation Award for Younger Writers and a Whiting Writers Award for Fiction. She's currently teaching at UCLA. It gives me great pleasure. Please welcome Mona Simpson and Michelle Hunnevin. Thank you.
Hi, thanks. I'm going to read just a little bit from this new book. And all you need to know for this section is it's in Lola, the nanny's voice, and that she works for two families. She works for a weekday family, who she works for Monday through Friday, and a weekend family. And in this section, she's leaving her weekday family on Friday and going over to her weekend family. I take Williamo to the post office, seal the envelope, and send my money home. $450 this week. A ticker tape of dollars runs all the time in my head. Last year, I totaled more than $20,000. In pesos, three times what Bong Bong earns, and he is executive hallmark. This year, it will be more because my weekend job. Besides what I send, I give myself allowance of $5 for daily spending. $25 go to my private savings, so when I return home, there will be some they did not know. Also, I need my account here for shoes or treats for Williamo or if one of the babysitters gets married. When you are working 7 days, you need some your own money. And I tell Williamo every day Lola requires her coffee. Is $25,090 enough to support a coffee habit on Montana Avenue? Lola is not a yuppie. I am here to pay tuitions and medicine in our country that goes 10 years. When we enter the house, the mother of Claire and her friend Tom are there. Tom says, 2 years ago, no one paid more than 50 cents for a cup of coffee. Now they're all spending $5 a day. That's a 500% increase. The mother of Claire goes every day to the coffee shop, but Tom, he will not attend. But I get the plain, only 150. Plus they give the sugar we use to make the cinnamon toast. I lift a handful of natural sugar packs from my pocket. Coffee costs them cents, Lola, cents. Does he think I'm spending the money of Claire and Paul? Compared with other parents here, my employers, they are not rich, but they are still rich to me. You have to pay what it costs where you live to join the club of life. Anyway, my weekend employer makes my coffee for me. I leave on the counter the receipt for tapioca and the change. Walking to my weekend house, I hear my heart. Tops of planted grains tick my hands. Sprinklers spray a chain on my wrist. From a long time ago, I remember the strangeness that comes with hope. Love, the way I have known it, it is also dread. I move slower when I see the house. My happiest moments are before. When I first married Bong Bong, I felt afraid he would die. Then, after my children, I worried they would die. I still had long hair, like my daughters now, and every night, Bong Bong worked on my neck. Time to work on your neck, he said. He made it a project, not a favor from him to me. He likes to turn his gifts invisible. Credit, the way children want it, would embarrass him. I laid down on the hard bed. He held my head on his knees. All those years, he never missed one night. He would start by extracting the sticks that kept up my hair. I felt the tug and loosening. What my weekend employers want that they do not have is me. I try to keep this light in the air. When I sit on the floor playing with Bing, Helen brings me a pale green mug steaming, the taste of something sweet and burnt. Drink it now, Lola. Today, when Jeff gets home, tonight, we're taking you out. The doorbell rings. Estelle, the mother of Helen, arrives to babysit. Why? But I am the babysitter, I say. I will be the one to stay home. We want to take you. Three is a crowd, I say. Helen tries to push me into the front, but I climb next to the car seat. The restaurant, it is all couples. Small candles on the tables and no children. I am not comfortable wearing my secondhand T-shirt that says Hard Rock Cafe. Here, I never attend restaurants in the night. It is all going very slow. I am looking around that no one will see us. Her sea bass is very good, Helen says, and people say she does a great steak. Employers and employees do not sit together at restaurants. I never once took my helper out to eat. She would have been embarrassed in a Manila restaurant. With the other babysitters, I am the one to talk. But here, it moves too slow. How are your children, Helen asks, while Jeff finally orders his food. I say all I want is soup. I am sounding like Vicky, but he tells me he is going to order me a steak because I never get meat at their house. Fine, I say, my kids, they are good. They tell me stories about Vicky. It is true, Vicky is not a good babysitter. I would never hire her for my kids. Maybe at this one thing, I am best. She still doesn't talk to us. I don't think she ever really liked us. At the play club, Vicky is Dal Dal. Actually, she is tomboy, what here they call lesbian. She likes the mother of Bing. It is the dad, she complains. No, Vicky likes you, I say. At last, our food arrives, and I keep my hands on my lap. The steak, it is many pounds, enough for the whole family of Lola. Then we eat quiet. The guy, he is serious, deboning his fish. He finally puts down his knife. Lola, we're going to fire Vicky. This is so fast, skidding. Too soon, something will be over. But Vicky is nice, is all I can think to say. I have heard about proposals like this. Professional parents go to the park to find a nanny and offer her double her salary. Maybe it is true for love also, what you see in the movies. I never believed those things before because they did not happen to me. My grandmother once saw the Virgin. The Virgin sat down, moving her robe to smooth it out when my grandmother took her lunch at the school. The robe was blue cotton, not velvet, a brighter blue than she had always pictured it, my grandmother said. I tell my daughters, do not trust roses. They will stink 1 week in the jar. Maybe I have been wrong. But Vicky was good for me. I never minded Vicky. They like me better, and that will never change. With someone new, who knows? Helen tells me they're paying you $55. He pauses, napkin in his mouth. They do not know my raise. I am now $62.50. I just signed contracts for two projects. We could start you at $100. $100 a day, like Lita. Maybe the things I heard before, even the man in the castle marrying the baby nurse. Maybe they all come true. It feels like the end. Darkness eats in from the edges. I think of the caramely coffee, fine silt at the bottom. But I will have to think, I say. They look at each other. They were expecting me to jump. Tell us, Lola, if there's anything we can do, because we really want to have you. He leans over. Would 110 make a difference? I say no to dessert. Outside the restaurant, the sky is dark blue. They tell me I can take the night off. You could catch a movie, he looks at his watch. It's only 8:30. Helen touches my wrist. Either way, still friends? I am carrying a small, heavy bag, my stake. More than friends, you are my weekend employers. They laugh. For them, that is a joke. For me, it is not funny. If I say no, what if the person they get wants 7 days? $110 a day. The last few minutes in the restaurant, they upped me 50 a week, more than my year raise from Claire and him. After 6 months, Claire raised me $5 a day, and again when he turned two, $7.50. I walk around the dark neighborhood, past houses where I know children, entering a room of jasmine and a smell of pepper. After one more year, Yamo, he will start in the school. I always work for free the day of his birthday and the one before. For their wedding anniversary, I give a weekend. I throw in the Friday night. And they celebrate the anniversary of my coming by raising me. So when Yamo turned two, that is when I became $62.50. Some of my friends get more, but their employers, they are rich. Also, if Claire asks me to work late, she will pay extra. Many here pay one price for live-in, no matter what you have to do. I always say to them, as long as I am needed. But 110 a day, 5 days or seven, up to me. That is 770 a week instead of 482.50. Per year, an extra 14,000. My God, I think I have to take that. Plus in that house, I will have my coffee made every day. That is 416 saved. Helen is young. They will want more kids, maybe two more. This is a good job for a long time. I walk all the way to the ocean to say good morning to the Philippines. I live Sunday in this life. There's a light wind teasing. The sky you can see through to ships far away at sea. We sit in Starbucks, Bing asleep in his stroller, and I write my letter home. This one a toddler, very easy. I do not have to clean. My career in America, it is up. For the first time, I keep my numbers private. They will guess a raise, but not this big. I need another international stamp. Tomorrow morning, I will walk Yamo to the post office. Those machines take pennies. I will have to find things to stack so he can reach the slot. On the stamps are pictures. I know from Bong Bong that is the job of someone to draw. But a needle starts in my heel. Sand scratches my mouth, opening a bad taste. I pray for a hint. I never ask for too much, from Bong Bong, from the teachers of my children, even from God. If you ask for only a little, maybe then the answer, it will be yes. As I come into the weekday house, Claire shouts, Lola, we're in here. Her arms cross. Yamo looks the way he looks when he gets bad, his face the shape of a box. This is my sign. My heart slopes. Do not worry. I whisper. Your Lola will not leave you. Monday morning at 6, I hand my weekend employer his newspaper. I cannot leave Williamo yet. Maybe I will be the one to raise your next baby. Oh, okay, he says, scratching the back of his head. Williamo is almost the age he will no longer need. 1 or 2 years more only. I will bring to you Indai to fill in until I come. Oh, okay, great. Anybody you know, I'm sure Helen will be glad to meet. Helen stands here now, too, holding a sweater over her nightie. But you'll still come weekends? As long as I am needed. $47.50 poorer, I want coffee. I fix Williamo his breakfast and take him to church. He is old enough now, I will teach him to pray. Pain shoots up my knees, the shape of a star fruit. This is a feeling I have known all my life, lowering myself in a high place. I understood after I married Bong Bong, I would never have a love affair. This is the closest I came, and see, I did not. I never wish for a different husband. In America, people make second marriages. Many women on our street, they are second wives. For me, a second marriage would be, I had a broken life. It is not what I think. It is not that I think Bong Bong is the only guy in the world I could get along with. But he is the one we had our children. Does that mean a Catholic can make herself happy with anyone? A good Catholic would say yes. An American would ask, but what about chemistry? Williamo, you light a candle. I count out 50 pennies for him to put in the offertory. He knows to whisper in the church. Can I make a wish? It is not that kind of candle. Watch. I hold my letter to the flame and burn my written presence home. A wafer of ash floats up and then lands, the last of it. I want to blow it out. Here you ask your prayer and let the candle burn. You already have your wish. I almost left. No more Lola. Now I can never tell Bong Bong. They will not understand. They would say, take the $100. I have cried already from this house too many times, Wolf. What is Pa Du? You read that? Not yet 3 years old. Another sign. There is no longer a letter, but I bring Williamo to the post office. We stay for a long time choosing stamps. In the bottom of the stroller, I keep our rolled pennies. I am in the mood to spend. I use the calculator to add up the money. If I stay until Williamo is 8, it will have cost more than $70,000. That is counting a $5 raise once a year. So Lola is romantic after all. I am the one who gave up the big bucks for love, but not the American sex kind of love. Thank you.
So hi.
So hi. You have to pull in your...
Oh.
That was great. So I think I'll start with the typical question that most interviewers start with, which is, when did you know that you had a book in hand? When did the idea take hold, and what was it?
Well, you know, we tend to work together a lot. With this book, I seem to have just been working on it for a long time, so I as soon as I kind of fell under the spell of that voice, I knew I had something in hand. Mm-hmm. So I just kept trying to make it into a book.
And so you started out with Lola's voice, and then you added Claire's voice. When did that come in, or did that come in right away, or did you write a lot in Lola's voice and then decide you needed a counterpoint?
I always wanted there to be the employer too. I thought it would be just right symmetrically, mm-hmm. to have the employer too. But I had a lot of trouble with that voice, ironically, though that's perhaps naturally, since that was the voice that was someone my age, someone my era, someone my culture. But that was the one I struggled with. Really, the Lola part of the book was done many years ago.
It's interesting how it's almost easier to inhabit an imagined voice than it is to inhabit a voice that's closer to who we are. I always think that writing closer to the age and the culture that I am is much more difficult because of, well, mostly because of disclosure. How much do you want to disclose? How close do you want to get? What do you think?
I've had that. Sometimes I've found that to be the case. Sometimes I've not, for some reason. That hasn't necessarily been the case for me, but it was for this book, almost because there wasn't that much room for... I was very aware of Claire's drama being, you know, a counterpoint to Lola's, so I didn't want it to take over the book.
But you were constantly bringing it up and making it... and bringing Claire's story. You used to say to me when she was writing it, I need more plot.
Yeah, that's right. But yet it couldn't be too much plot because I didn't want it to sort of
overwhelm it.
Run away with the narrative.
Yeah, exactly. And can you talk a little bit about working with Lola's voice? Because I know that initially it was a lot more intensely, more of a dialect than what you ended up with.
Yes, I can definitely talk about that because I thought about it for so long. I sort of got that voice in the first place when I moved to Los Angeles when I had a little baby. And at the time, I was sent by my pediatrician to a mother's group, and I went. And it was a mother's group. There were a few people I'd gone to high school with. I was sort of returning to L.A. after having been away for a long time. And the mother's group was great, but kind of daunting. These mothers, few of them had their first child. They were very, very certain. I felt I was doing everything wrong. I don't know. It was a bad time of day for me. It wasn't working. So what I mainly did then, and actually I was in two mothers' groups. Then another novelist I knew here started a working mothers' group. And the other mothers' group had been midday, which wasn't convenient because I wanted to try to work. But at the same time, they were very casual and nice about it. They put out a thing of coffee and a bowl of goldfish, and that was the end of it. The working mothers group met at 6 o'clock after a lot of these women had jobs, and they came in suits, and then they cooked a four-course dinner. And it became this sort of competitive. And every time we all said, we can just get pizza. You know, why are we doing this? And everyone agreed, and yet the next time there would be another, even more impressive four-course dinner. So I ended up just taking the baby and putting him in the stroller and going to the park, where I fell in with a group of nannies, and some were Filipinas. The majority of this particular group were Filipinas, although there were some other nationalities, I guess, represented too. And one nanny in particular, who was never my nanny, whose name was Carmen De Ferio, and who actually introduced me to a woman who later became a friend. So in a way, that section of the book is, I was the one who envied my friend, her nanny. And she had just the most amazing sort of storytelling voice. So I sort of fell into that voice. And also, that was the artistic side of it. The practical side of it was, these women were, for the most part, women who'd raised three or four kids. They weren't nervous about it. They gave offhand advice that was very sensible and kind of always right and not likely to make one hysterical. So they were an enormous help to me, too. Mm-hmm. But when I first did Lola's voice, it was very laden and very dense and very very vernacular, sort of infused with all the vocal tics and hesitations. And a lot of people felt, almost every professional person, my editor, my agent, everyone, felt that it would just be too hard for people to make their way through it. Now, not that that would have stopped me. In fact, it didn't for quite a while. But then I began to sort of think about it a lot, and I thought that, you know, any of us who speak more than one language, and I do only haltingly, but you know, if I'm in a language that isn't my first language and I get to something too hard, what I usually do, and I'm sure what everyone does, is you just sort of translate when you're thinking into your native language. So I then made a distinction between the dialogue of Lola and the narration. So the narration is a bit flatter and the dialogue is more inflected. And then after that, I also, as I went through the book, she's here for quite a while, this nanny, you wouldn't know from this section, but she's here in America for some years. So I wanted her voice to kind of grow. I wanted her English to build and become more supple and sophisticated as the book went on. That's the sort of thing probably you could easily read the book and miss, but I enjoyed.
I don't think so.
I enjoyed putting it in and getting it right.
So that leads into the next question, which is about research. You obviously spoke to a lot of nannies, but you obviously did a lot of other kinds of research for the book.
I read a lot of books for this book. I went to the Philippines. I had a lot of fun researching this book. Writers now apparently have to have websites, so I got a website. And the part of my website, the only part I'm particularly attached to, is I took a picture of the stack of books I read for this book. I read what I enjoyed the most were sort of old manuals of how to become employed as a servant if you were an immigrant looking for a job here. Those were very fascinating, as were the manuals for women hiring a helper as to how to sort of manage the person and get the most work out of them, etc. I also came across a great trove of letters from the Department of Labor in the Women's Bureau, which were letters written by domestic workers. Especially, there was, for some reason, right after the New Deal, after Roosevelt passed the New Deal, and there were all these new rights and protections for almost every kind of work in the country, but domestic workers or workers in the home were not covered. So there was this incredible outpouring of letters from all over the country written by domestic workers, essentially to Mrs. Roosevelt, to the president, to Mary Perkins, to who was the secretary of the head of the Department of Labor. So there were all these, Frances Perkins, what am I saying, Mary Anderson, her assistant. And there were all these very kind of plangent, heartbreaking letters that they have copied in the Department of Labor and for $100.
Did you put one in the book?
I put one in the book.
You want to read it?
Sure. So I had a lot of fun doing that. Let me see if I can quickly find that. Dear President, there were thousands, but I loved this one, and partly I loved it because it was written from here, from L.A. Dear President, I am a married, this is exactly word for word, the way it was. Dear President, I am a married woman and my husband has been out of work for nearly 18 months. I have been doing housework to keep my home together. I have one boy, 4 1/2 years old, and it is very hard for me to leave my home and work at housework by the week. I get $12 per week. I work from 7 in the morning till 8 at night, and if they have dinner parties, I work much later, and all I have off is from 3 o'clock one afternoon during the week and on Saturday afternoon. I wish you could do something to shorten the hours. I do not mind working to support my family, but I sure do hate to be made a slave of. I hope, dear President, you will not overlook us poor things that has to work for the wealthy. I sure hope my husband will get work, and I sure think if things keep up the way you have been doing, everything will come back wonderful. Dear President, we poor things want to thank you so much for all you have done. Sincerely yours, Grace Wicker, 17 Mercer Avenue, Altadena, California. P.S. I sure hope you can do something so I can be home with my little boy, for I feel he needs me. Thousands of these.
Wow.
It's very heartbreaking. And of course, sadly, it's like a sort of like a message in a bottle thrown out to the ocean. And the truth of the matter is there are still not those basic rights and protections for domestic workers.
Well, now I have a question about the characters in your book. Do they pay their nanny Social Security? Do they pay into Social Security? Are they...
One couple does, and one couple doesn't.
And
I'm sure in both, in either case, it's not for the right reasons. Mm-hmm. I did an op-ed piece on, because there's some legislation pending in New York. So I talked to a number of people about whether they paid their nannies and housekeepers and whatever. And I have to say, I didn't put this in the book. It's too topical. But and the book was done too, for that matter. But a lot of people also told me they wanted to pay their domestic worker, but they went to their accountant and they had to file all these papers. A lot of people have told me, we have always paid because my husband had worked in the U.S. Attorney's Office, and that's just something that everybody there did after the Zoe Baird mess. But I think I probably initially with babysitters didn't want to, because I learned to know the wrongness of my ways.
Now, there are things in your book which I read many times, which I assumed were the result of research, which you've told me recently are actually the product of imagination. And one of these things is, in the book, there's a lead nanny named Ruth, and she sort of takes care of all the nannies. Her house is open to them. They come to her on their days off. They have beds there. She's an interesting character in and of herself, and she's been in America for a long time, and in fact sort of rescues Lola when Lola needs rescuing. And she has something that Mona has entitled The Book of Ruth, which is kind of a book of history. It's a scrapbook and a book of etiquette. And I assumed that, like so many readers, that it had its equivalent in reality. So I guess I want to ask a general question, specific question, which is, how did that come to be? And just the process of imagining as you write, how does your imagination take hold and work? And maybe ask...
question. I don't even know. I mean, I think I probably... It's the kind of thing you'd love to find as a writer. You know, wouldn't you love to talk to some nannies and find this book, which was sort of a record of their lives? It's kind of an amalgam. People will throw in a recipe or some advice, but also it's their memorial. If someone dies while they're here, that the nannies will put a picture and write. But this is all just made up, but wouldn't you love to find that in a way? I guess it's because I did all this research, and that's the kind of personal document I was looking for in all the research and didn't find. So I had to make it up.
Yeah, there's a wonderful letter in it from La Reina, which warns nannies not to get too high and mighty and ask for too much and too secure, because and not to become the queen, because then they'll lose their job. And she signs it La Reina, the queen. So your book brings up, you know, countless issues of this milieu. Who's a good parent? Who's not a good parent? In the Claire and Paul couple, Paul works quite a number of hours, about 10 to 10, and it's a strain for Claire, who's an awkward young mother. He is bringing home the bacon and making a very nice life and working very hard trying to break into television as a television comedy writer. So what's sort of hovering in the book is how good a parent is he? He's lovely with the children. And
with the child,
with Williamo, and also Williamo's friends. He's
That's
the
true.
Life of the party. And one can, at times, build a case against him. And then at other times, there's an irony, which is that what about Lola herself, who is so loving and such an incredibly good parent to Williamo, but has abandoned her own children in order to do this work.
And Lola's children happen to be older, but there are a number of nannies in the book, and as in real life, who are actually here working with very young children back home, wherever back home may be. I mean, varying depending on the person, but there are a number of people who are in their 30s who are here working. I mean, this is not news, but that's true, of course.
Mm-hmm. And so it just is a question that hovers over the book, and one of the many resonant ironies to some degree that you know, some of the best child rearing is done by people that have abandoned their own children. There's also some interesting questions about slavery. There's a book, there's a character in the book who's an actual slave who's being kept by people who do not let her have free run. And then there's May Lee, who is can come and go as she likes, but is sort of not paid by people who are very wealthy and live on the West Side and continue to buy you know, very expensive clothing items, even as they don't pay their nanny. And what can she do?
They feel they have cash flow problems.
They have cash flow problems, don't we all? Yes, cash flow problems, except when it comes to that pretty little blouse. So I guess when you are writing a book, are you consciously aware of these ironies, or are you building on them, or do they arise as a product of character, or is it a kind of a building thing? I mean, do you write about these things, or do they come out of character?
I think everything sort of comes out of character a little mm-hmm. bit, but all of the above, you know, sometimes you just stumble on something that you find that's good and so great, let's use it, but often mm-hmm. often you have to...
Because one of the great pleasures of the book are the sort of social ironies that you paint so well, so convincingly. Now, changing the subject a little bit, and speaking of social ironies and writing about things thematically... In a number of recent magazine and newspaper articles, your book has been brought up next to Jonathan Franzen's book. And there's the subject that sort of the Mona Simpson and Laurie Moore, one article said, write excellent books about family, and they're called excellent books about family, whereas Jonathan Franzen writes a book about family, and an excellent book about family, and it's called The Great American Novel, or A Major American Novel. What's your response to that?
You know, my response to that is I bet what your response is that, I hope, but I think, you know, it's so incredible that this many people are reading Jonathan Franzen's book that I don't even feel it's a sexist thing at all, because it's just so exceptional that it would be exceptional if it happened. I mean, there are so many men, white men, you know, whose novels aren't read. It's really phenomenal. I mean, there's a husband I know who hasn't read a novel in 15 years who's read it and loved it, and there's another husband I know who hasn't read the novel but read about it and has been writing memos to his company about what freedom means and what Jonathan Franzen thinks. It's kind of great. I think it could potentially just energize the American public about reading fiction, but at the same time, I don't know, it concerns me a little. There's been so much talk about whether the attention is partly gender-based. There was an editorial today in the Times about how he's sort of writing about a dystopian America. So much of the talk has been about ideas surrounding the book, which makes me worry about, for all of us, because I don't know if any of you follow these intelligent, brilliant, dramatic television shows that are on now, but if anyone, you know, watched Mad Men or something, or The Wire or Friday Night Lights or any of these good shows, after an episode airs, you go on the internet and there are just chat rooms and websites that are arguing about the characters, and everyone is talking about what Peggy did last night. And somehow with the novels, they're talking about whether it's on the cover of Time magazine because he's a man, a privilege, or because, you know, I mean, I feel like we'd all be better off if it were a more visceral fight about whether Patty Berglund should have slept with Richard.
Well, I think that takes place in book clubs. There aren't really TV clubs, TV episode clubs.
Maybe that's right.
There aren't Mad Men clubs.
Maybe there are.
Well, maybe. Where everybody gets together and makes a casserole or a big four-course dinner and watches Mad Men. Maybe.
Could be. So that's what I think. I think it could be a good thing. I mean, do I think that, I guess there's been studies done about various places and who they cover, and certainly, you know, I think probably still women are covered a little less, and people of color are probably covered a little less, and I think there probably are disparities, but they're hard to really.
Actually, there's an article coming up in The Nation in an October issue that was pre-published today that said it ranges from about, men get anywhere from like 55 to 75% more coverage than women do.
That's probably true, but then again, I think that's probably true.
Yeah.
Pardon? Yes.
Yes.
That's
exactly.
True.
Now, I just have to, oh. So it's getting to that time in our program when we can engage with the audience. I actually had a question. Do we have some students here? We do, who've taken Mona for...
Oh, yes.
There they are.
Hi.
And there's Diane. Hi, everybody.
Oh, it's my seniors. My former seniors. My honors students.
Look at them. A nice row. And there's Diane.
There's Diane.
I thought it would be fun to ask you guys what Mona is like as a teacher. It's something I'd like to know.
Oh, no.
and that it would be fun. Horrific? No.
No, it's actually, it's a little bit like studying with a Zen master. Because you work really hard, you do your karate kicks, and you train your body as much as you can. You go through the pain, and then she'll sort of read it, and she'll read from other masters, and you get sort of that kind of like a little sentence that will then guide you to try and go back and reread what you're working on and then rework it so that it becomes more the voice of actual human beings and more the voice of life. And it's very challenging, but it's also very rewarding. So I think when I read Mona, that's, for me, is what is the great inspiration, is that it is... incredible poetry, and it is real people on the page. So, and that's what I think we all aspire to to be able to create. But we're still going through the pain. We're not the masters yet. We're just hurting.
Hi, I also studied with Mona, and we all did a thesis project. This little tiny four-person section did a thesis project with Mona, and she stayed up with us until, I don't know, it was like three or four in the morning.
Emailing
back and forth, and the comment I kept getting was, you need a more authentic mother. And it was almost impossible for me to create, but there's just something about being around Mona and then reading her work, and there's a level that you aspire to, and she can just look at something, she's such a careful reader that she can just tell you, you know, in a sentence what it needs, and then you can give it to your work, and she really honors the work and believes in the written word, and is a pleasure, an absolute pleasure to study with her. So
they all got A's.
Actually, I think we all got A plus. But we had to work really hard. For me, Mona was sort of this just pillar of subtlety. She wouldn't gush over you, even if you did something that you felt was great. She would be sort of, I always thought of Mona as like the steel fist and the velvet glove. She was serious, serious and firm with us. You know, she didn't give us unnecessary praise to prop us up. She treated us like adults. And not just because we happen to be kind of an older group, but with the kids who were, you know, traditional college-age students, she treated them the same. And Lisa's right, you know, we'd get, you turn in like a 20-page story and get one scribbled sentence on the back. And I'd go home and read that sentence to myself over and over, and at first be just agonized, like, oh my God, did she hate it? Did she love it? Am I terrible? Whatever. And then usually what would happen is I'd wake up the next morning and just think, it's like a surgeon's scalpel. It's the exact one single thing that I needed to know. And I think that's a great gift, to be able to read carefully and give a student something that is so sort of subtle but respectful. And, you know, that kind of guidance is just rare in the world. And also, Michelle, you were our teacher too, and we loved you. And it so, you know, thank you.
I don't know how I can follow all that. The only thing I'll add is that I agree, like, Mona can really very quickly, and I think Michelle too, you know, read something and know right away, like, these are the problems and this is what works. And I think that really comes from, one, loving writing, like, respecting writing, and also reading a lot. And I'm really, really realizing now that I'm out of school and I don't want to read ever again. That you're just reading a lot and really getting to know the craft of writing, so you can very quickly and easily see what works, what doesn't, what a story needs, what a character needs. Like, that's so important. I think it comes from writing, but it really comes from reading a lot too.
Thank you. We have now a question from the audience down here. Where? Oh, yes. Here, the microphone is coming. Thanks, you guys.
Hello. I must admit, I haven't read your book, but, and this may obviously be answered if I do read it, but I was a little concerned in that you said that the nannies you felt had abandoned their children, and almost in a derogatory way. And I have had nannies in the past, and I never felt that they abandoned their children, because emotionally they were very tied into their children, and it was only through circumstance that they had to come to this country to be able to send money back. And I never, ever thought that they had abandoned their children.
I believe abandon was my word, not Mona's.
Yeah, I wouldn't. I think Michelle was just making the point that there are ironies in the book, and that I think there are all kinds of standards we hold ourselves to when it's a matter of choice. I mean, I've known people who've worked, I'm thinking of somebody whose mom, somebody I know whose mom growing up worked as a house cleaner and worked long, long hours, and wasn't home most nights when the kids got home from school. But they all knew that that work was for them. It was, and so I think it's very different that the employer, one of the employers in this book is a composer and is trying to work while having a child. I think it's a very different thing to work at something you love than it is to work, you know, for money to help your kids. And I think everyone in every family is kind of aware of all those choices on some level every minute. There's been studies apparently of kids that they can differentiate different kinds of inattention in their caregiver. So, no, I wasn't judging the nannies harshly.
I loved the book.
Oh, thank you.
And I wanted to ask you about and compliment you on one very short passage. I was really touched by the passage about Park Century School. In one page, maybe a page and a half, I felt like you completely captured the whole essence of that school, the energy of it, the special gifts of the kids there, the experience of the parents. And I wanted to ask you about your familiarity with it, or what kind of research you did, because you really kind of nailed it in such a brief passage.
Oh, thank you. I'm glad. I'm surprised, too, because I only went there once. I went once for a tour for a friend's kid who didn't end up getting in. So that's my only experience of it, but I was touched by the place. Oh my God, I feel like I want to brush it up.
Any other questions on there?
Hello. This is my colleague.
What a wonderful book.
Oh,
I just galloped through it.
Thank you.
I wondered if you could talk more about sex and love in the book. It was terrific that you ended with that part where Lola says, I'm in love, and I chose this love. It's not the sex kind of love. But there is a way in which Lola, she has this kind of thoughts about Bong Bong, right?
Going to the
Philippines. And then, of course, it's a huge part of Claire for me in the book. So I wanted to know how you thought about
that. Well,
that's
going to be the next book, the Sex and Love book. I need to do some more research first. I felt that this book was, to some extent, about that sort of middle-aged, you know, our generation's middle-aged, what would you put it, displacement of sex and love, and obsession to some extent with children and all that, and our particular way with putting that at the center of our adult lives. But I was kind of joking, but the next book I hope will be about sex and love, and I hope I can. It's the hardest thing in the world is to write a good love story, you know, almost impossible.
Mona talks a lot about romantic hope
and the lack therein. I just read, Michelle suggested to me that I read Villa. We were talking about Jane Eyre, which of course we both have read many times in love, and Michelle said, oh, you have to read Villette, and it was exactly the right book for me at the right time. I don't know how many of you have read it. It's her last novel. It's in some ways deeper and better than Jane Eyre, but in many ways kind of a mess too. But it's kind of her real grappling with, it's kind of George Eliot mixed with Charlotte Bronte. You know, it's the more realistic side of it all. It's fascinating to me. So.
And does it have romantic hope?
Villette?
Yeah.
I don't want to spoil the ending. You wouldn't necessarily say it's definitely not Mr. Rochester getting his sight back. Let's just leave it at that.
We had another question here. Yes.
Yes.
I'm not quite finished, but I really love it, so thank you very much.
Well, thank you.
If Claire hadn't been a musician-composer, what would she have been?
She had to be some sort of something that worked at home. I wanted it to be, you know, she couldn't have been a lawyer, an editor, a doctor, a businesswoman. I remember at the time when I had a baby, I had a friend in New York who was an editor, and she had 6 weeks off or something, then she went back to work, and she absolutely, positively had to go. I mean, there was no, she would either quit or she would go. There was no in between. And I was struck by the difference in our lives in that way. So I wanted her to be somebody who had some wiggle room.
So why don't you talk about why you made her a composer and what your experience, I mean, living in the house with all the musicians and...
Oh, yes. Well, you know, I don't know why I made him a composer. I did live in an apartment in New York. I lived in a building that was, I want to write about this building someday, although somebody has actually written a book about it, a different kind of book that I would write altogether. But it was run, the man who owned it, people used to say he's a Holocaust survivor and a crook, and kind of both were true. And you know who I'm referring to. And his sort of sidekick, who did most of the legwork of sort of reading applications and letting people in, loved music. And it was kind of a bad New York apartment building. Nothing was up to code or anything, but it was great at the same time. It had great views and it was cheap and we all loved it. But it was all musicians because he let in musicians because they gave him tickets. And I got in as a complete anomaly But it was this, it was almost like being in a sort of a Juilliard practice room. And when the walls were good, it was a pre-war building, so when you were in your apartment, it was pretty quiet. But you stepped out in the hallway, it was like a practice room. You know, it was everybody practicing. It was fantastic. And I got to stay and eventually moved up in the rankings because the guy, the owner, appeared at my doorstep one day and said, "I understand you're a writer." And I said, "Yes." He said, "Well," he wanted me to type up a memo because people were putting pots on the window ledges of flowers, and he thought they would fall and kill people. So I wrote that memo. That was one thing. Then the second thing, he appeared with his granddaughter, who wanted nothing more in the world, nothing more than to go to the University of Michigan. So he wanted me to write her college application. They'd gone to a private college counselor who said, you know, there are too many Jewish American girls from Long Island who want to go to the University of Michigan. They're cutting down. There's not good. She's not. It's going to be tough. And so I had these sessions with Suzette where I would say, okay, now, you know, what activities have you done? Well, I went to Israel and I, you know, did this and this. So I wrote this very saucy essay that directly addressed it. And I thought it was quite. I tried to get her to do it, but you know, like, this is the bad parent in me. I gave up eventually and just did it myself. And then we sent it in, and we heard nothing. And then I really, really worried because I thought, oh, my God, I've been too cheeky, and now I've ruined her chances maybe. And so then I was friends with this woman whose husband taught at Michigan because he had gone to Yad, one of these writers' colonies with her. So I called Tish O'Dowd. I don't know if you ever ran into her. I said, "Oh God, could you find out when they're going to let them know?" You know, and it turns out her husband was in the Department of Admissions. So Suzette got in, and I got an apartment on the 15th floor, and I lived there a long, long time. Suffice it to say.
Okay. Is there one over there? Okay.
Here.
Can you talk a little bit about the specificity of place? I mean, you said you spent a lot of time in LA. How much is the LA setting important versus the characters, or how would the book be different if it were set in New York or London or San Francisco? Or
That's a good question. You know, I just never even considered setting this book somewhere else other than LA. I don't know why. You know, it's kind of a nice thing for a writer to grow up somewhere and then go away and come back. I feel it's probably completely false security, but I feel very confident writing about Los Angeles. I feel like I kind of know it to the bottom, which is, you know, why would I? Just because I lived here? I mean, you know, there are thousands of lives going on simultaneously here every minute. I just have had my one. But I do nonetheless feel a kind of assurance that, say, I lived in New York 17 years, I would never feel that writing about New York, about the social world, the physical world. I wouldn't have it. And who knows, maybe false confidence can be good.
One more question? Yes. Two more.
Specific compliment, which is that reading through it, I came to the section where it was the Book of Ruth, and I mean, it was literally like being lifted off my feet. It was like reading along and reading along and admiring it, and then to read the section where it starts the Book of Ruth, and it's just, I mean, it's so extraordinary, and to think that it's, one sense that it probably was invented. You know, somewhat, to hear that it was invented out of whole cloth is just, you know, really remarkable. I mean, that is, for me, at least, the moment where the book just lifted you up. But it's just...
Oh, thank you. That's so nice.
Truly, truly wonderful.
Thank you.
Okay, one last question. Right here. Mr. Gold.
Hello, Mr. Gold.
Hello, Ms. Simpson. There's one scene in the book that I think is one that a lot of people remark about, that you have Lola, who, although she doesn't make very much money, is sort of obsessed with specific sums in almost an unprecedented way. I mean, almost like a, you know, a nanny Jane Austen. And, you know, she knows what a penny is. She knows the difference between, you know, 62.50 and 45. But, and there's that scene when she goes to New York to with Claire. And she, I think she has ideas about the wealth of the household. And she comes across that check that Claire is getting for a performance, and she looks at it, and it's about what she makes in a week. And she's flabbergasted because she thought that she was working this hard for money, and it's obviously for something quite different. And I think there was supposed to be a sort of resonance there. That's supposed to be like, you know, a ringing of the bell, a part where, like, Lola suddenly realizes something. But in some senses, it doesn't seem as if she's realizing. She just doesn't understand. What do you think?
No, I thought she did. I thought she did and she didn't. I mean, she... No, I thought she did understand, actually. And I think, you know, one of her daughters, too, is not wanting to work simply for money. And that's, so Lola kind of has it from a couple of different directions. And she wants a world in which things are clear. But Lola, too, has her sense of the ephemeral and the enigmatic and the mysterious. And that's one thing that keeps them kind of together for as long as they're together.
And I also think it's part of the novelist's arc, because I think that when she finds the check, that Jonathan's right, that when she finds a check, she doesn't quite understand it, but it sets a seed in her to where she begins to think more and more about what she would do just for love. So it's right. it's a nice scene. It's a nice bit of novelistic technique. Okay,
thank you, Mr. Gold. And thank you, Ms. Hunnevant.
I think that concludes our event this evening, and we'll both be signing books. I guess
we'll join you in the lobby in just a moment.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Aloud Audio is produced by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, Righteous Persons Foundation, City National Bank, K&L Gates, KPMG, the Boujakji Foundation, Susan and David Rosenblum, Wallace Foundation, and Donna and Martin J. Wolf. Media support provided by KPCC 83.9 FM, KUSC 91.5 FM, and public television station KCET. Additional support provided by the Council of the Library Foundation and individual Library Foundation members. A loud theme composed by Larry Karish.